Hello and welcome to Canary Pod, a podcast from the team behind the Canary. I'm Kerri-Anne Mendoza, the Canary's co-founder and editor-in-chief. Each week, we bring you a look behind the scenes at the biggest stories of the last 7 days. Today, you are the company you keep. Most of us grew up listening to this warning from our parents or guardians. Its meaning ranged from plain snobbery to a genuinely cautionary note about courting the company of popular yet harmful people. Its origins rest in the Proverbs of Solomon, captured in the Book of Proverbs of the Old Testament. Proverbs 13:20 reads, "He that walketh with wise men shall be wise, but a companion of fools shall be destroyed." Which brings us neatly to Theresa May and her clown car government. The people this government appoints to its top jobs, the companies to whom this government chooses to outsource our most critical services, the friends and associates of our cabinet ministers. These revolving doors and cosy relationships are creating a company of fools, and they're overdue a destroying. Joining me today, we have Canary UK editor Bex Sumner and Canary journalists Freya Lockley and Steve Topple. Welcome, everyone.
Hello.
Hello.
Oh, it's good to be back. It's been a few weeks. I have enjoyed listening to you guys, though. It's been lovely. Steve, let's start with you. We need to talk about Carillion. What's going on and what's it got to do with fracking?
Indeed, we do need to talk about Carillion. Just as a bit of a background for anyone who may have been buried in, I don't know, Celebrity Big Brother or Dancing on Ice or something similar, Carillion is an integrated support services business that provides outsourcing of contracts to the government. It held about 450 government contracts, employed 43,000 staff, directly and indirectly. Its contracts range from 11,500 hospital beds it maintained, 1.4 billion joint venture in HS2 that it had been given. And of course, this week on Monday, the 15th of January, it went bust. The whole company went into liquidation. It's important to state that it was kind of missed in some of the media. There's a real difference between liquidation and a company being dissolved.
Yeah.
Liquidation essentially means that this company is no more. If it was being dissolved, it could have been turned into a smaller company and still maintained. But liquidation, all over, game over, it's finished for Carillion. The reason for Carillion's liquidation, it's essentially collapsed under £1.5 billion of debt. It was issuing profit warnings from July last year when investors were getting extremely concerned about the performance of the business. Mm. This rumbled on for the whole of last year and eventually it essentially buckled under the weight of the money it owed to the banks.
And they were actually given, what was it, I think £2 billion of government contracts in the last 6 months while three profit warnings were issued.
Indeed, yeah. It got eight government contracts from July 2017 onwards, one of them relating to HS2, two of them relating to the Ministry of Defence. The most recent one was given, I think, on Monday, the 8th of January. It was a contract for Leeds County Council to build a road. Yes, all of this amid extreme profit warnings, changes in who was heading up the company, and yet the government are going, "Oh, it'll be all right. Oh, yeah, let's give them another contract."
This just speaks kind of volumes about our government's procurement processes, doesn't it? That they can give, these are, you know, we're talking about the Ministry of Defence. Mm. We're talking about a high-speed rail network line, mm-hmm. which is, you know, the first time we've done a project on this scale in this country.
Yes.
And they're giving it, they're handing the contract to a company which has issued several profit warnings and has collapsed within a couple of weeks.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a multifaceted story, if you like. There are so many threads to this, which I think we should have time to touch on all of them.
Yeah.
But yeah, absolutely. It kind of encapsulates the failure of, as you say, the procurement system of government in this country. I mean, sort of to lead into one of the stories I did this week on Carillion, this should have been a warning sign, if you like, from the outset with Carillion, because I uncovered via my friends in a fracking campaign up north that the interim chief executive of Carillion, Keith Cochran, was also a non-executive director of a fracking company. Now, this fracking company, Third Energy, is it couldn't really get any better, could it really? This story is the unpleasant gift that unfortunately keeps on giving. So Keith Cochran, non-executive director of a fracking company called Third Energy, they've been granted a license by the government to extract shale, as we call it, in a place called Kirby Misburton in North Yorkshire. There's been protests going on at the site since December 2016. Loads of people involved. We've had politicians up there. There was even an incident where Green Party co-leader Jonathan Bartley was dragged away by police.
I remember that.
That tensions are running so high now. So this guy, Keith Cochran, interim chief executive of Carillion, also non-executive director of Third Energy. So this fracking company, Third Energy, it has been dogged by controversy over the past few months. It's been discovered that it has a parent company called Third Energy Holdings, which is registered in the Cayman Islands.
Oh, so they're not paying any taxes then?
Well, Third Energy, in response to a request from the Canary, claim that they pay all UK tax on profits made in the UK as per government instructions regarding the ring fencing of profits for oil and gas companies. However, which is true. However, what the setup with this is that Third Energy Holdings, registered in the Cayman Islands, has lent £44 million to Third Energy Limited in the UK to fund its operations. So what happens is, essentially, Barclays ultimately own Third Energy Holdings. Barclays are ferreting this money via the Cayman Islands to avoid some tax somewhere or not, and then that money is transferred to Third Energy Holdings in the UK to fund the company. They have been issued with warnings of being dissolved from the government because they haven't been filing their accounts on time. They still haven't filed their accounts for 2016. They're now nearly 6 months overdue with that. And they've reported, I think most crucial to this, the company reported losses in both 2014 and 2015 of £4.4 billion and £3.8 billion respectively. Now, this is a company run by the interim chief executive of Carillion, a company that's had profit warnings, that's making losses, that's registered in a tax haven, and yet, obviously, no one flagged up that, oh, well, this guy's doing this with this company. Do we think he's suitable to manage a massive multinational outsourcing corporation?
I'm sorry, I'm actually speechless. Already in a situation where clearly the government can't make a sensible decision about the right company to which to grant some of the most critical services in our country to. And then the interim chief executive, I mean, where was the background check, or do they just not care?
Exactly. The thing is, Kerri-Anne, as I said earlier on in this section, the whole story of Carillion, it's a multifaceted, multiple thread story, if you like. We go from, if you like, the willful ignorance of government and civil servants to what's going on, essentially just shrugging their shoulders and going, oh, well, we believe Carillion when we say they can negotiate with the banks over the billions of pounds they owe to them. You have that. You then have the nefarious nature of the financial system we live under, where, as has been widely reported, you have hedge funds short selling, that is betting that Carillion's going to collapse, and making millions upon millions of pounds out of it. Hedge funds, which is important to add, the majority of them are registered in places like the Cayman Islands, so they're avoiding the tax that they should be paying on the money they're making off the back of a company providing public sector contracts that has collapsed. You then have the ridiculousness of the British economy, because you have RBS complaining about the fact that Carillion is not paying it its money back, and RBS withdrew its services from Carillion just a couple of days before it collapsed. Yeah. RBS is 73% owned by the taxpayer. So Carillion owns 73% of what it owes to RBS, to us. Hello. And then you have the then you have the closeness of the politicians to all this. For example, the Conservative Party accepted a £50,000 donation from a company called Nayar Capital Management last year, when Nayar Capital Management were profiting out of short selling on Carillion. And then you have the likes of this guy, Keith Cochrane, running a dodgy fracking company, who's happily made the interim chair of Carillion. And as I also reported this week, you have a guy called John Kingman, who's Legal & General's chief executive. Legal & General is slightly up to their eyeballs in Carillion because they run one of its pensions funds and they have 1.3 million shares. He's just been made permanently the CEO of UK Research and Development's investment arm. It just the whole story encapsulates everything wrong that is not only failing in government, but it's also failing with the creaking financial system we live under. It just sums everything up. Unfortunately, the narrative we've been getting from a lot of the media has been focusing on the PFI, the Private Finance Initiative aspect of this, and how that is failing. This story is much bigger than that. The story is about a broken global financial system.
I think, Steve, that's actually one function that new media can provide that maybe mainstream media can't provide at the moment. It is, as you say, it's putting something like this Carillion collapse in its truest context. Mm-hmm. So as you say, they've kind of almost taken a microscope to PFI at the moment. When you think of all of the issues that this brings up, you know, to do with, you know, revolving doors, cozy relationships, you know, this almost like a corporate and political class that we have now, which are just kind of playing musical chairs with positions of power. And these questions need to be asked because, you know, the answers have a massive impact on the future of us, our families, our, you know, our public services in our country. And as you say, the world. Now, this is a global problem. This is not just a UK domestic issue. This is really about the economic system that we're running and how, in many ways, it's absolutely subverting democracy. Because those decisions are being made, you know, predicated on what's best for this economic system.
Yes, absolutely. Again, as you say, it's almost sort of extra governmental, isn't it? So many of these decisions are made away from politicians. There's a massive sort of implication and questions that need to be asked over the role of civil servants as well in this.
Absolutely.
It's a story which really does encapsulate all the challenges that society faces at the minute, and unfortunately a lot of the right questions are currently not being asked.
Okay, can I just say also that obviously a huge story, as Steve's saying, the biggest story around, but on the day it all kicked off, the Evening Standard decided not to dedicate its front page to it. Instead they went for a front page that about internal Labour Party processes, basically fear-mongering about the election of three Momentum-backed candidates to the NEC.
Wow.
They briefly put out a front page in their first edition focusing on Carillion, but the second edition was like Corbyn reds under the beds fear-mongering. You have to wonder why.
Shameless.
I know. But remember who the editor is. George Osborne.
Yeah.
He's up to his eyeballs in all this too. So firstly, he supported Carillion's takeover of public services. He made a big announcement about how it was one of the Carillion deals was part of the Tories' long-term economic plan for Britain. He oversaw a doubling of outsourced public contracts between 2010 and 2015. But mainly, he earned £650,000 a year from a company that profited from Carillion's collapse. So he now works for BlackRock, which apparently reportedly earned £40 million profit by gambling.
This makes me so mad.
It's worse than that, because the register of interest showed that he was expecting to get equity in the company when he started working there. And if he does, it means he effectively got paid directly from the collapse of Carillion.
So he's hedging.
Well,
he's hedging. So
BlackRock is, and he gets £650,000 a year working for them. So
but he personally is hedging because he's telling us, hey guys, here's a great opportunity. We're gonna outsource this stuff. It's gonna be great. Economies of scale. Yada yada blah. And we all go, oh, we're not sure. We think this is quite risky because, you know, companies collapse. And he's like, it's okay, guys, everything's covered. And then he's going home and like, I should probably hedge myself against the risk of this actually, you know, sinking the economy. And he sets himself up with a nice cushy deal. So that in the event that what we've already warned happens, he literally profits from it. He makes money. Well, people lose their jobs, people lose their homes, you know, public services don't get delivered on time. Come on.
It's an absolute disgrace. It's an absolute disgrace. To be fair to him, he did put out an editorial, but Carillion was the second story in that, below a story about straws. And
literally straws.
Literally straws. I mean, it was, I think it was, I can't remember, I think it was plastic usage in a standard campaign or something. And he used it to basically pass the buck away from ministers onto civil servants for the whole sorry shambles about Carillion.
Absolutely. I mean, this is what Steve touched on as well, isn't it? It's like, now you know why they're talking about PFI and having a bun fight. You know, this whole Carillion catastrophe is now turned into the right wing of the Labour Party saying, hey, we didn't mean it with PFI. You know, the Tory party going, oh, well, you know, PFI was all Gordon Brown. And us and the maybe on the left of the party going, literally the entire time you've been doing PFI, we have said this is exactly what was going to happen. We are over this story. This is not news to us that PFI could have bad outcomes. You know, we're well aware of that. We're looking at sort of the, you know, the, what is it, like a quarter of NHS trusts that are in PFI schemes are also now in deficit in the budget. Some are handing over a fifth of their annual budget to pay for PFI schemes. This isn't news. We know that this is bad. But the thing is, if they focus on that, then they don't have to focus on the other questions, like, did people like George Osborne literally hedging, you know, to make sure that he would personally profit if this went the way that most sensible people warned it would. You know, yeah. We don't talk about the personal relationships happening behind the scenes.
You know, it's like, you know, former Home Secretary John Reid
outsourced huge chunks of the Ministry of Justice to G4S. Who's he working for now? G4S. You know, the same with Tony Blair and JP Morgan. The same with George Osborne. You know, and it goes on and on and on. They make decisions in government that they're warned about the effects of. They deny those effects are real. They happen, and they've already insulated themselves from the results of those effects because they've created a cushy deal elsewhere. It's the company
of fools. Exactly. It all comes back to the revolving door, doesn't it? And this culture of, you know, the corporate government. And yeah.
Well, we will be staying on that story. We'll be following all the way through, and we'll be doing our best to kind of pick up all of these issues so that our readers can discuss them and actually get involved in trying to deal with them. So thanks for that, Steve. That was a really great run through of that. It does seem like kind of every day we're learning something newer and darker about that case, so I don't expect it to be going away anytime soon. And you can follow it as it develops at www.thecanary.co. And Bex, from a bad company to bad company. Esther McVeigh was promoted by default in Theresa May's hokey-cokey reshuffle. She's now the Secretary of State at the Department of Work and Pensions. So she'll be taking over welfare reform, or as it's known to most, the assault on the welfare state. And can you tell us a bit about McVeigh's past, Bex, and why this appointment adds another fool to the mix?
Yeah, this is an absolute shocker. So McVeigh, like you said, brand new work and pension secretary, she's now responsible for reducing work-related deaths and injuries as part of her new role.
Right.
And in her past, she helped run a demolition firm. It's a father's firm, J.G. McVeigh. It's now closed. She was a director from 2003 to 2006. And that firm, while she was there, was twice ordered to stop work by safety inspectors because to protect workers from serious injuries.
You've got to be kidding me. She's responsible Theresa May has recruited someone to be responsible. So when you're the Secretary of State of the DWP, you're responsible also for reducing workplace injuries. And the person that Theresa May has recruited and appointed to that post, her previous company got done twice for creating workplace injuries.
It's worse than that, because it was they stopped work twice because of it. But it's the company's own records from 2013. One of our journalists, Tom Wall, was involved in tracking those down for another, you know, for environmental health news.
Okay.
It showed that they repeatedly breached safety regulations 4 times and the Health and Safety at Work Act 3 times. So it wasn't just a couple of. It doesn't seem from those that it was like a couple of aberrations. It seemed to be like a systematic disregard for workers.
What do you even say?
I know, everyone kind of mutters about health and safety and blah, 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 but you've got to remember why we have this stuff.
Yeah.
Why we have these rules in place. Like, it's to stop serious personal injury or death. That's life-changing serious personal injuries. You look back through history before we had the regulations, and I was just looking through the HSE website now just to look at the history of industrial accidents and stuff, and it was brutal. It was brutal. So, in the 19th century, building the UK's railways, 3 workers died for every mile of track laid.
Wow.
Much higher in tunnelling sections. You know, accidents, lung diseases in miners, long hours, dangerous working conditions, death from chemical explosions, asbestos exposure. All of this stuff is a disgrace and needs to be regulated. Corporations need to be regulated so they don't play fast and loose with workers' lives.
Yeah.
But we're heading back that way. You know, we've come so far since then. We're heading back that way. Conservatives have totally slashed the health and safety executive budgets. They've cut safety. Last year, 137 people were killed at work. Falls from height were 25 of those. So, I mean, these breaches were for stuff like not having guardrails on scaffolding and using chainsaws without the right equipment and stuff. They were serious breaches.
Yeah.
This should not be happening.
This is the thing when people kind of complain about red tape and health and safety. I notice most of the people making those complaints, you know, maybe work in an office, you know, maybe like the most serious thing they're going to face that day is a paper cut. And I speak as someone who works in an office who, you know, is likely, you know, the most dangerous my day gets might be a paper cut. So I'm not judging those people. I'm just saying we're not necessarily best placed to understand just how dangerous some jobs can be without the right levels of protection.
I was talking. I was talking to a friend's grandfather fairly recently, and he was talking about working in steelworks.
Yeah.
Watching his colleagues, his friends drop it. You know, accidents that happen there involving molten deaths that happen there involving molten metal. Just devastating stuff. So yeah, and it's very easy from the comfort of your chair to go, oh, blah blah blah, health and safety. But
exactly, it's always easy to do that when you're not going to face the consequences of the outcome. I think that's the thing. I think for a lot of people, it's just they have it like it's this big personal burden on them, but it's really not. Like, it doesn't affect them at all if a company they're never going to work for, never going to have any association with, is held to the appropriate level of health and safety standards. It really doesn't affect them at all, you know, but it has a massive impact. I mean, and the thing I think for people to remember is it actually is only relatively recently that the kind of workplace safety laws really came into force. You know, we're not talking about like, you know, back in the mines of, you know, kind of early America here. We're talking about relatively, I can remember, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s, I was headed to university. And one of the students at Sussex University what you do when you're at uni, you odd job, you know, you sign up for a temp agency and you just take whatever, you know, job comes through that day. You know, so you don't necessarily have a standard job. You just kind of, you're a pool of employees that are just ferried off to places in a minibus in the morning. So this guy's in his first year at Sussex and he's, you know, signed up to one of these agencies and he gets in his minibus and he gets out and he's at the docks, I think the Shoreham docks, which are there just sort of west of Brighton. And it's literally like the morning, he's never been on this docks before, he's never done any work. and he's working on the kind of, you know, the kind of big things, which I forgot the word now, but basically it's lugging about very big boxes, you know, cargo containers and things. He's standing there minding his own business, and one of these cranes turns around and it decapitates him.
Wow. You know,
takes his head off. You know, and I can remember this was the whole context of me going to university. It was posters everywhere about this guy, and Mark Thomas, you know, the comedian and activist, you know, kind of came to town, and there was this big, massive push to you know, change health and safety laws, particularly for very casual labour, which is what this guy was. And that's, I think, the stories that we need to keep telling people, you know, is like there are real people that get seriously injured, ill or die, if we don't get these things right. And it's imperative that we have a Secretary of State in place, the person ultimately responsible for shaping our country's approach to this issue. We need someone in that post that we can trust and rely on to make good calls. Where is the evidence that Esther McVeigh makes good calls on this or anything else?
Can I just chip in at this point? Because I think there's a broader point to be made, if you like, with this story, Bex and Kerri-Anne. Obviously, as you allude to, the sort of degradation of health and safety at work rights, it plays into this more broader notion of what's going on at the minute, which is the tail end extremism of the neoliberal corporatist individualism that has been peddled for the sort of past 30 years. That we're seeing now the state taking less and less responsibility for what happens in our lives, from health and safety at work matters to your actual health outcomes within the NHS, the health and welfare of disabled people, the rights of the consumer. It's been the responsibility for these things being taken away from the state and from corporations, and it's being placed onto the individual now in extremes. And this is, in my opinion, a very, very good and very pertinent example of that, that you have Esther McVeigh running this company, which flagrant health and safety, really obvious uncaring attitude towards that. Yeah. And now this woman is in charge of the welfare of disabled and sick people in this country. It's the erosion of any notion that the state and corporations have any responsibility to the individual anymore. It's putting everything onto our shoulders, if you like.
Absolutely. And of course, this is again, this is only one issue we're talking about with Esther McVeigh. This is not the only issue with this appointment, which is even worse.
Exactly so. John McDonnell described her as a stain on humanity. Of course, the Canary cannot condone that kind of language. however, disabled people had a lot to say about her. My friend and leader of Disabled People Against Cuts, Linda Burnett, called her the shit that rises to the top. There we go.
You've got to love Linda. She's got a way with words.
Indeed.
Okay, fantastic. So, Bex, is there anything else that we need to tell our readers about this story?
Well, yeah, I think it's just really important that we all remember that how hard won all these rights have been. Yeah. They've been won generally over history in spite of politicians, not because of them.
Yeah.
And it's, we've got to really watch out for it all slipping back in front of our eyes. We've got to really fight to keep them.
I absolutely agree. And I think, you know, you've touched on a really central point there, because it feels like that with a lot of stuff right now. You know, it feels like we're in a really pitched battle right now, to kind of not necessarily advance the social contract, simply to retain it. You know, sort of we're having a very it feels like a pivotal moment where we could either like go off down a kind of an Americanized economy approach, or we could stick with social democracy. And I think that's part of the reason actually things are so inflamed in terms of kind of political debate at the moment, because it's a very big question, you know, to face as a country. And I respect the fact that people do hold different opinions. But I think, you know, part of the reason it's so difficult to have a quiet conversation about any of these issues that we're touching on today is they are all life and death issues. You know, they really are that important.
Yep.
So thank you for that, Bex. And again, you can continue to follow this story. We will be absolutely on Esther McVeigh's tail throughout her tenure. at the DWP. I think we were all doing that before we even worked at the Canary. So we'll certainly be doing it now and making sure that we keep you up to date on the latest information and also give you ways that you can actually get involved yourselves to feel a part of this struggle rather than a passive observer of it. So cheers, Bex. And last but definitely not least, let's go to Freya. Oh, the Toby Young travesty just keeps rattling on.
It's ongoing, doesn't it?
It just doesn't stop. It just, every day I wake up and I feel yet more sick about this weird appointment of Toby Young, but we'll get into that. Freya, can you remind our listeners where this all started and then where we've actually come to with the latest revelations?
So it was announced on the 1st of January that Toby Young had been appointed to a newly formed Office for Students, which is a regulatory university watchdog. It's kind of the equivalent for universities of Ofgem and Ofcom, right, but with an added component that HEFGE, who deal with universities funding, were also going to come under the umbrella of this newly formed body. So whoever was appointed to that board has a lot of influence in terms of regulating universities, but also to do with funding.
Okay.
People working in HE were not happy about many of the appointments, but the appointment of Toby Young, and I'll come back to that in a moment, tipped it over the edge, really, because of his long-standing, outspoken opinions. He's been, for a very long time, his style of commentary has been, to say the least, I think it's okay to say this publicly now, it's sexist, homophobic, and incredibly dubious and incredibly worrying.
Yeah.
What really foregrounded was the way the appointments were made, because along with Toby Young, I mean, he was the worst of the lot, but they also, to this, they appointed the previous managing director of Boots, somebody who'd formerly come from HSBC. Wow. There were very few people on the board who'd actually come from universities. Somebody was there from Rose Bruford College, which is a private university. The student representative that they chose was somebody nobody had heard of, who hadn't stood and campaigned for students. They overlooked the head of the NUS. And so a lot of people who'd applied for this position were completely overlooked, didn't get through. And the final board that was appointed was pretty much appalling and didn't have the kudos, the knowledge and the understanding that people working in higher education felt it should need. And Toby Young was the icing on the cake, really, all of those appointments. There was a lot of controversy about it. Tom Pride started a petition, and over that week, as news grew about Young's appointment, that petition gathered more and more support. Also during that week, Toby Young deleted, they think, over 40,000 of his tweets. So the appointment was made, people criticised his appointment, and suddenly, as though he thought we wouldn't notice, he deleted loads of the abhorrent things that he'd said.
Sure.
And tried to sort of, he did the classic Toby Young thing. In the one, he claimed he was being attacked by a pitchfork Twitter mob, but also repeated some of the horrible things that he'd said.
Yeah.
I think what's also interesting with Toby is that he was appointed to The Spectator at the time when Boris Johnson was there. So Boris Johnson appointed him to The Spectator.
Mm-hmm.
We come along to the 1st of January 2018, and at that point, before the hokey cokey, it was Joe Johnson, Boris Johnson's brother, who had overseen this appointment.
Mm-hmm.
And then Boris Johnson stepped in to defend him and said that we needed his kind of caustic wit.
Wow.
I don't know where we even begin to go with thinking about those links and quite how and why they thought that he should be in charge of British universities, including funds. And he set up some free schools, but really that,
He set up a free school with no experience and then it failed and he wrote several opinion pieces saying, cool, didn't realise how hard it was to run a school.
Yeah, the Ofsted reports that he set up were appalling, and yet he seen as some kind, well, they were claiming through this appointment that he had all the experience that they needed. I don't know how or why. Very quickly, though, one of the big questions that was asked was how and why he was selected and how on earth he got through the recruitment process, especially when you go back and look at the job description and realise what is required of a position like that. Theresa May defended him.
Yeah.
Everyone was coming out and defending his appointment. And yet when you match that up against what was actually in the job description, so it was extremely questionable how he'd been appointed. Roberta Blackman Wood sent some letters asking specifically that question, who was appointed to the board, who put those decisions through, and many questions were never given a direct answer at that point. And during this time, the petition gathered more and more supporters, and there was, leading up very neatly to the announcement on the 8th of January that he'd stepped down from this position.
A whole glorious week in.
He lasted a week, by which point the petition had gathered 220,000 signatures. But did he fall or was he pushed? Well, that's really interesting because, Kerri-Anne, you wrote a great story about this, as did Tom Coburg.
Yeah.
I would imagine it was hours after he announced his resignation. It also turned out, and this was uncovered by a student at University College London, that he was due to, Toby Young was due to speak at a conference. It was the London Conference on Intelligence, speaking about eugenics. I mean, where does it begin and where does it end with Toby Young? I don't know that they, to
well,
hold.
This is, I mean, that conference gets worse and worse as well, the closer you look at it. You know, this is something that was, you know, funded and pushed and advocated for by essentially a bunch of white supremacists.
With neo-Nazis.
These are full-on neo-Nazis.
And, you know, I think both you and Tom covered this brilliantly, that it was as though he was trying to hide that under the carpet, thinking that maybe nobody would know.
Yeah.
And then his justification of why he was there, does he really think we're that stupid? I don't know.
It's outrageous. I mean, this is a guy who's literally published columns advocating for what he calls progressive eugenics.
That poor people basically shouldn't have more children. And he effectively was saying that poor people are stupid, therefore let's stop them breeding. Was the, you know, he's tried to justify and defend that, but when you read what he actually wrote, I don't really see how he can.
Well, it is that classic thing that we see from guys like Toby Young, you know, who say, "Look, I'm being progressive. I'm saying what I'm trying to say is, you know, we should publicly fund." So that poor people can have their embryos tested for intelligence so that, you know, we can help the poor people out and improve social mobility.
Yeah.
And what they don't get is that they have literally just made an assumption that the reason those people are poor is because they're stupid.
Yeah.
It's nothing, like, never mind the economic system that we know entrenches inequality and poverty. No, it's actually because poor people are breeding in an inferior way.
And he just that progressive eugenics, which I think is even more problematic. Eugenics full stop.
Yeah.
But advocating as though that this is something socially that will help the population. I struggle to believe that anybody can hold those views, but B, that they should publicise and write about them and somehow think, well, who is the audience for those kind of ideas? I don't know if I want to know the answer for that.
Well,
can I just chip in again?
Yeah, sure.
I think, again, there's a bigger picture aspect to this, and there's an important point that needs to be made. Toby Young's views on what Freya, you refer to as progressive eugenics, if you like, this is now all coming to the surface. As my partner Nicola Jeffrey said to me last night, these views have never gone away.
No.
They're just in the Tony Blair era of PC, it was not acceptable to say them. And now it's becoming acceptable to say them again. You only have to look at Ben Bradley, who was exposed this week as saying that poor people should be be sterilised. If you look at the policies of government, for example, the two-child limit on tax credits, that is essentially stopping poor people having more children. We're seeing this sort of 21st century eugenics creeping back, if you like, sometimes subtly, and sometimes in the case of Toby Young and Ben Bradley, not subtle at all. And we need to be very wary of that. And I wrote an article a few weeks ago now showing that it seems to be having an effect, that essentially the richest socioeconomic classes are now reproducing, having children at higher rates than the lowest socioeconomic classes. For the first time in years, poorer people are now, birth rates are dropping among poorer people. And whether we like it or not, there is something happening here with the notion of, as you say, progressive eugenics. It is seeping back into the political discourse.
No, I absolutely agree. And I think you've raised a good point there, that it's just worth touching on too, Steve, about this, the visibility of these attitudes to people. And I think you've made a really good point, which is, you know, I've had a friend, a very close friend of mine, you know, we're fairly aligned politically. And she said to me the other day that, you know, she broke down in tears when the Brexit vote happened, because she felt like this country that she thought she lived in, this like tolerant, accepting, welcoming country, didn't exist. And I said, well, it never existed.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't feel like that on the day that Brexit happened, because it didn't exist. And so she says to me, oh, you've always been more cynical. And I was like, no, I've always been brown.
Exactly.
And I think that's something, you know, there were great things about not having to listen to these bigoted views in public. I do miss a little bit some days that, you know, that 90s, early noughties, you know, political correct time. But I think one of the risks with something like that is, I think for a lot of liberal, left of centre, you know, white, straight people, they might never hear or see the racism.
Yeah.
And actually begin to believe it no longer exists, because it's not present to them. Whereas I think, you know, people who are, you know, living with disabilities, or they're gender nonconformists, you know, or they're gay or bi, or, you know, gender, whatever they are, you know, their skin color or their ethnicity or their religion is classed as other. You get exposed to a very insidious form of bigotry in those periods of time, where you know what's happening, the person who's doing it knows what's happening, but no one else present knows what's happening. And these very, you know, kind of indirect forms of bigotry, which are much harder to explain to people and much harder to eradicate. And I think one of the things that's happening now is, you know, these views, progressive eugenics didn't just start yesterday. You know, racism didn't just erupt in Britain in June 2016. You know, none of these issues just suddenly happened. You know, people at the sharp end, you know, have been dealing with these issues all their lives. It's nothing new to us.
Do you think that have we sort of lanced the boil and drawn the poison to the surface? Is there actually something positive we could take from this? Or are we tipping into a point where maybe views like this are going to become more normalised? That's what really worries me about.
Absolutely.
It's like the Toby Young thing emerging. Is like, arguably, it could be positive if these views are coming forward. Does that give us more leverage to challenge them in the open?
I think we have to have... almost like every generation has to have like its settlement conversation. Like every generation likes to choose its culture. You know, it wants to choose how it feels about economics. It wants to choose how it feels about politics. It wants to choose how it feels about race and ethnicity and religion and those things. Every generation wants to choose its views on those things. So, you know, I remember for us, you know, we inherited the kind of, you know, I'm 36, you know, we kind of inherited this, you know, you're just, you know, born in 81, you know, we're talking about, you know, our parents grew up watching like Love Thy Neighbour and Alf Garnett and On the Buses and Carry On films, you know, and women were like, ooh, ah, and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, our generation said, we want that to be different. And we came in direct conflict with not only older generation, you know, there were people in older generations who wanted to stick. There were people in older generations who felt we were right.
I wanted to move. And so you have this big social conversation. The result of that conversation was political correctness.
Yeah.
You know, so we said, we don't want it in the public space. You can have your views, but you keep them to yourself. You know, you don't put it in the workplace. You don't put it in politics. You don't put it. And that was how that stayed for a bit. And now that is in flux because we've realised actually that kind of there are issues with that approach. You know, you don't deal with the conversation. You know, we're not having the conversation. Our solution was we're not going to have the conversation. So I think it's positive to me in the sense that we have to have this conversation because we have to deal with racism, not just put it in a box and pretend it doesn't exist. Because I think that gives a certain section of the population an inappropriate level of comfort. And it means that people who are actually dealing day to day with racism and bigotry don't necessarily get the support that they need because everyone thinks the problem's gone away. But at the same time, you know, there is a danger, as there always is, you know, as we've seen countless times in history, that the progressives lose.
No, absolutely. And I think, Kerri-Anne, you touched on an extremely good point, which is that that people our age, because I'm the same age as you, embrace this kind of PC culture, if you like. And yeah. we've now essentially found that la-la-la, fingers and ears attitude to this hasn't worked. And more broadly and very briefly, what this issue of progressive eugenics and where we've come to now regarding the attitudes of many people in society, it feeds into every other damn story we've been talking about today. Yeah. Because ultimately, at the root of all this is the global establishment elite, which is running society and which is ultimately fostering these kind of views and fostering this blame culture of anyone who is on the fringes of society, if you like, for the problems of our global financial and societal system. It's all the one and the same thing. And it's ultimately when you break it completely down, that's what needs addressing on every issue we've covered today.
Absolutely. And that's what we're talking about. It's the company of fools. You know, anyone listening has not yet had the honour and privilege of watching the artist Taxi Driver do his stuff on YouTube, I recommend you do it. You know, he does fabulous rants about, you know, we are led by the least amongst us. You know, and I think it's so right. I think, you know, everything we've spoken about today, from, you know, from Steve to Bex to Frey, you know, each of you have brought something here which just proves, you know, we are not led by the best among us. No. You know, the best people are not in the right positions.
Absolutely.
You know, so little wonder, really, that we're in the state we're in right now. Little wonder. You know, I think probably the only ray of sunlight in all of this is it does feel like the conservative juggernaut is shuddering to a painful halt, but it's a long stopping distance. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's quite literally as though the scales are falling off in front of our eyes. So, but will that stop them?
It will. I mean, no one thought Thatcher or the Conservatives were ever going to be stopped in the 80s. You know, it was just like, this is it. This is the new ideology now, you know. They're going to continue this to, you know, to the bitter end. And you know, that didn't happen. You know, the Conservatives have got overthrown, but their ideology was retained. And I think that's the reason, I think, not to go off on too much of a tangent again, but I think, again, that's the reason why the conversation about the future of the Labour Party, the future of progressive politics in general, has become so fractious. You know, people are like, oh, why is there so much infighting in Labour? Well, it's because there's a cluster of people saying, look, we know we might technically be able to scrap a general election win by a couple of seats if we don't look too scary and look a little bit like nicer Conservatives. That might be possible. But the reason why we shouldn't do that is what the hell we're living through now. You know, we're living through now the consequences of doing that before, of stopping the Conservatives but allowing their ideology to permeate into the centre of our politics so that essentially their project continued. You know, PFI continued and sped up. Academy schools continued and sped up. You know, the privatisation and marketisation of the end continued and sped up.
You know, so while the Conservatives might have been having an awful time being out of power, you know, multiple leaders being considered a joke, in their heart of hearts, they knew they'd shifted the ideological goalposts, you know, and we were still playing their game. And I think what we need now is to not only end the Conservatives in government, but end the Conservatives in ideology. And that means a radical shift. So that it's, you know, it's almost like Monopoly, you know, when everyone's bought up all the stuff on the board and you just, there's just no game anymore. You know, there's just a couple of people being exceedingly rich and kind of bored as well because there's nothing more they can do with it. So you just empty everything back into the box and you start again. Feels kind of economically like that's the point we're at now.
And the other thing, Monopoly, when you get to that point, is friends start dealing with each other to get rid of everybody else on the board, don't they? I've seen that.
Which
is exactly what they're all up to now. I've got three hotels. Do you want one? Then we can screw that person over.
Yeah, it is. It's really messy. And I think that's the, I think the deceitful conversation that neoliberals have is they keep pretending like we're all on our first go round the board and it's a completely fair game. And we're on like our millionth go round the board. It's completely rigged. If you've got no property now and no wealth, it's likely that's the way you'll end the game. This is a conversation that I think the public is having at the moment, actually. I think almost like this podcast episode is the conversation that many people are having in their own ways, in their own homes at the moment. It's like, what's the world going to look like? You know, this game feels unfair. How can we redesign it so that more of us can play, more of us can contribute, you know, more of us can feel a part of, you know, making the world a different, better place? And it's a great and inspiring conversation at its core. But I think it's scary because we're so far from it right now. And because things are trending down in so many important areas, I do think that has us feel like that's the way it's always going to go. But I'm not convinced it is. I think we'll turn this thing around. Thanks for that, Steve. And Freya, is there anything else we need to know about this story? What are the next moves on the Toby Young travesty likely to be?
I think keep an eye on him because I don't think those kind of views are going to vanish. But I think one thing this did foreground that was incredible was the public response through the petition, and that hopefully the more of us who have these conversations start talking to each other and keep that kind of pressure on, more of that, the better.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for that, Freya. And of course, also keep an eye on this Office for Students. Because I think there's actually going to be, in the longer term, I think that's going to be where our focus needs to lie, on what this Office for Students is actually about, what's the intended result of putting it in place, as well as these dodgy appointments. So thanks, Freya, for bringing that to us. And obviously, we'll be continuing to cover it at the Canary. And obviously, thanks to Stephen Becks too. As always, listeners, we give you plenty of ways to get involved in the issues raised in the podcast. And details will be posted in the show notes for this episode. That's us done for another week at Canary Pod. Please make sure you follow us at Canary Pod on Twitter and use the hashtag Canary Pod to carry on the discussion. And do also make sure that you subscribe and review Canary Pod on iTunes or whatever platform you're listening to us on. It helps more people to find us and to listen into. We'll see you next week. Until then, remember, don't get angry. Get involved.